no further raw data was to be turned over to the full committee. And that was the extent of it. And Gray himself is the one who reached the conclusion that no more information could be turned over. He turned over enough. So this is, again, Pat Gray making decisions on his own as to how to handle his hearings. He has been totally unwilling all along to take any guidance, any instruction. We don't know what he's going to do. He's not going to talk about it. He won't review it. And I don't think he does it to harm you in any way, sir.
He's just quite stubborn. And he's quite stubborn. Also, he's just very smart.
He's full-headed.
He's smart in his own way. But yeah. He's got that typical, I don't know, this is right, and then I'm going to do it.
That's why he thinks he'll be confirmed, because he thinks he's being his own man, he's being forthright, honest, he feels he's turned over too much, and so it's a conscious decision that he is harming the Bureau by doing this, and so he's not going to.
I hope that God will take it off and figure it out today. This is because the White House told him to do this rather than the other day. And also, let's remember, I don't see why our lawyers can't make something out of the fact that Terry, this is the only responsible decision you could possibly make. The FBI cannot turn over wrong files. Anybody made that point? I have tried to say.
Sam Irvin has made that point himself. In fact, in reading the transcript of Gray's hearing, Irvin tried to hold Gray back from doing what he was doing at the time he did it. I thought it was very unwise. I don't think that anyone is criticizing your position.
Let's make the point. Let's make the point that the raw files cannot be handled. Well, I mean, that point should be made. Yeah.
That might have been a bad call, because he is an incredibly cautious person and wouldn't have put the situation where it is today. All right, after rejecting that, they said, we still need something. So I was told to look around for somebody that could go over to 1701 and do this. And that's when I came up with Gordon Liddy, who they needed a lawyer. Gordon had an intelligence background from his FBI service. I was aware of the fact that he had done some extremely sensitive things for the White House while he'd been at the White House, and he'd apparently done them well, going out into Ellsberg's doctor's office and things like this. He'd worked with leaks. He tracked these things down. So the report that I got from Pruitt was that he was a hell of a good man, and not only that, a good lawyer, and could set up a proper operation. So we talked to Liddy. Liddy was interested in doing it. Took Liddy over to meet Mitchell. Mitchell thought highly of him because apparently Mitchell was partially involved in his coming to the White House to work for Crowe. Liddy had been at Treasury before that. Then Liddy was told to put together his plan, how he would run an intelligence operation. And this was after he was hired over there at the committee. Magruder called me in January and said, I'd like to have you come over and see Liddy's plan. January of 72. Like, you come over to Mitchell's office and sit in on a meeting where Liddy's going to lay his plan out. I said, well, I don't really know as I'm the man, but if you want me there, I'll be happy to. So I came over, and Liddy laid out a million-dollar plan that was the most incredible thing I have ever laid my eyes on, all in codes and involved black bag operations, kidnapping, providing prostitutes, to weaken the opposition, bugging, mugging teams. It was just an incredible thing. And Mitchell just virtually sat there puffing and laughing. I could tell because after Liddy left the office, I said, that's the most incredible thing I've ever seen. He said, I agree. And so he was told to go back to the drawing boards and come up with something realistic. So there was a second meeting. And they asked me to come over that. I came into the tail end of the meeting. I wasn't there for the first part of that. I don't know how long the meeting lasted. At this point, they were discussing again, bugging, kidnapping, and the like. And at this point, I said, right in front of everybody, very clearly, I said, these are not the sort of things, one, that are ever to be discussed in the office of the Attorney General of the United States, where he still was. And I'm personally incensed. I'm trying to get Mitchell off the hook, because he's a nice person, doesn't like to say no under when people he doesn't have to work with. So I let it be known. I said, you all pack that stuff up and get it the hell out of here, because you just can't talk this way in this office, and you should re-examine your whole thinking. Came back. It was Magruder, Mitchell, Liddy, and myself. I came back right after the meeting and told Bob. I said, Bob, we got a growing disaster on our hands if they're thinking this way. And I said, the White House has got to stay out of this, and I frankly am not going to be involved in it. He said, I agree, John. And I thought at that point the thing was turned off. That's the last I heard of it, when I thought it was turned off, because it was an absurd proposal. Liddy, I did have dealings with him afterwards. We never talked about it. Now, that would be hard to believe for some people, but we never did. Just the fact of the matter.
Well, you were talking about other things.
We had so many other things.
Yes, legal conference.
Now,
because you were his advisor, I understand. I get your advice on what are the campaign laws. I did that because you had all the authority because you were making all the laws. Go ahead.
Now, so Liddy went back after that and was over to 1701, the committee, and this is where I come in to having put the pieces together after the fact, as to what I can put together, what happened. Liddy sat over there and tried to come up with another plan that he could sell. One, they were talking, saying that he was asking for too much money, and I don't think they were discounting the illegal points at this, after, Jeff is not a lawyer, he didn't know whether this was the way the game was played or not and what it was all about. So they came up with apparently another plan. But they couldn't get it approved by anybody over there. So Liddy and Hunt apparently came to see Chuck Colson. And Chuck Colson picked up the telephone and called Magruder and said, you all either fish or cut bait. This is absurd. absurd to have these guys over there and not using them. And if you're not going to use them, I may use them. Things of this nature. This was apparently in February of 72. I can only assume because of his close relationship with Hunt, he had a damn good idea of what they were talking about. A damn good idea. He would probably deny it today and probably get away with denying it. But I still... Unless Hunt blows on it. Probably. But Liddy was there also, and if Liddy were to blow... Go back over that and tell you where I think the soft spots are.
I think he
helped to get the push, get the thing off the dime. Now something else occurs though. No, I think this is an independent. No, I don't think so. Now, but here's the other thing where the next thing comes in the chain. I think that Bob was assuming that they had something that was proper over there, some intelligence gathering operation that Liddy was operating. And through Strawn, who was his tickler, he started pushing them to get something, to get some information. And they took that as a signal. Magruder took that as a signal to probably go to Mitchell and say, they're pushing us like crazy for this from the White House. And so Mitchell probably puffed on his pipe and said, go ahead. And never really reflected on what it was all about. So they had some plan that obviously had, I gather, different targets they were going to go after. They were going to infiltrate and bug and do all this sort of thing to a lot of these targets. It's knowledge I have after the fact. And apparently they had, after they had initially broken in and bugged the Democratic National Committee, they were getting information. The information was coming over here, too strong. Some of it was given to Haldeman. There's no doubt about it. I don't really know if he would. Not necessarily. That's not necessarily.
Strawn
knew it was Strawn. No doubt about it. And whether Strawn, I've never wanted to press these people on these points because it hurts them to give up that next inch. So I have to piece things together. All right. So Strawn was aware of receiving information, reporting to Bob. At one point, Bob even gave instructions to change their capabilities from Muskie to McGovern. And it passed this back through Strawn to Magruder and apparently to Liddy. And Liddy was starting to make arrangements to go in and bug the McGovern operation. They'd have done Plymouth.
They had never bugged Muskie.
No, they hadn't, but they had infiltrated it by a secretary and a chauffeur. Nothing illegal about that. Now, so the information was coming over here, and then I finally, after the next point in time where I became aware of anything, was on June 17th, when I got the word that there'd been this break-in at the Democratic National Committee, and somebody from the committee had been caught, from our committee, had been caught in the DNC. And I said, oh my God, that I can only, instantly putting the pieces together. I knew what it was. So I called Liddy. On that Monday morning, I said, Gordon, I said, first I want to know if anybody in the White House was involved in this. He said, no, they weren't. I said, well, I want to know how in God's name this happened. And he said, well, I was pushed without mercy by Magruder to get in there, get more information. If the information was not satisfactory, Magruder said, the White House is not happy with what we're getting.
The White House.
Well, I think it was probably Strawn thinking that Bob wanted things. And because I've seen that happen on other occasions where things have been said to be of very prime importance.
Why didn't really want to let it change? I'm just trying to think as to why that. We just finished the Moscow trip.
That's right.
Democrats have written on to the government. I mean, for Christ's sakes, what the hell would we...
I don't know, other than the fact that they might have been looking for information about the conventions. Because I understand also after the fact that there was a plan to bug Larry O'Brien's suite down in Florida. So, Liddy told me that, you know, this is what had happened, and this is why it happened.
Liddy
told me
he was planning where to learn there was something planned from.
Beg
pardon? Where did he learn there was plans to grab O'Brien's sleep?
From Magruder, long after the fire. Yeah, Magruder is totally knowledgeable on the whole thing.
Yeah.
All right, now, we've gone through the trial. I don't know if Mitchell has perjured himself in the grand jury or not. Mitchell. I don't know how much knowledge he actually had. I know that Magruder has perjured himself in the grand jury. I know that Porter has perjured himself in the grand jury. He's one of Magruder's deputies. That they set up this scenario, which they ran by me. They said, how about this? I said, well, I don't know. If this is what you're going to hang on, fine. But again,
they said
before the trial and the grand jury that Liddy had come over as a counsel, and we knew he had these capacities to do legitimate intelligence. We had no idea what he was doing. He was given an authorization of $250,000 to collect information because our surrogates were out on the road. They had no protection. We had information that there were going to be demonstrations against them, that we had to have a plan to get information as to what liabilities they were going to be confronted with, and Liddy was charged with doing this. We had no knowledge that he was going to bug the DNC.
That's untrue.
That's right.
Magruder did know that.
Magruder specifically instructed him to go back in the DNC.
He did?
Yes.
You know that? Yeah, I see. Okay.
I honestly believe that no one over here knew that. I know, as God is my maker, I had no knowledge that they were going to do this.
Bob,
I don't believe specifically knew they were going in there. I don't think he did. I think he knew there was a capacity to do this, but he wasn't giving a specific direction. I think Strawn did know. All right. So, those people are in trouble as a result of the grand jury and the trial. Mitchell, of course, was never called during the trial. Now,
Mitchell has given the sworn statement.
Yes, sir.
To the
grand jury.
Did he go for it?
We had an arrangement whereby he went down to with several of the, because it was, you know, the heat of this thing and the implications on the election. We made an arrangement where they could quietly go into the Department of Justice and have one of the assistant U.S. attorneys come over and take their testimony and then read it before the grand jury. That's right. Mitchell was actually called before the grand jury. The grand jury would not settle for less. The jurors wanted him.
And he went.
I don't know what he said. So I've never seen a transcript of the grand jury. Now, what has happened post June 17th. Well, I was under pretty clear instructions not really to investigate this, but this is something that just could have been disastrous on the election if it had all hell had broken loose. And I worked on a theory of containment to try to hold it right where it was.
Right.
There's no doubt that I was totally aware what the Bureau was doing at all times. I was totally aware what the grand jury was doing. I knew what witnesses were going to be called. I knew what they were going to be asked. I had to.
Why did Peterson play the game so straight with us?
Because Peterson's a soldier. He kept me informed. He told me when we had problems, where we had problems, and the like. He believes in you. He believes in this administration. This administration has made him. I don't think he's done anything improper, but he did make sure the investigation was narrowed down to the very, very fine criminal things, which was a break for us. No doubt about it. They ran that investigation out to the fullest extent they could follow a lead, and that was it.
But the point is, the word, I suppose, he would be criticized for not doing that job. Why didn't he call them all? Why didn't he get a statement? Colson. Well, they didn't get Colson.
That's right. The thing is, based on their FBI interviews, there was no reason to follow up. There were no leads there. Colson said, I have no knowledge of this, to the FBI. Strawn said, I have no knowledge of, you know, they didn't ask Strawn any Watergate questions. They asked him about Segretti. Just said, what's your connection with Liddy? And he just said, well, you know, I just met him over there. And they never really pressed him. They didn't, you know, they looked. Strawn appeared as a result of some coaching, to be the dumbest paper pusher in the bowels of the White House. All right, now, post June 17th, these guys immediately, it was very, very interesting. Liddy, for example, the Friday before, on I guess it was the on the 15th, or 16th of June, had been in Henry Peterson's office with another member of my staff on campaign compliance problems, joking. After the incident, he ran Kleine's down at Burning Tree Country Club and told him that you've got to get my men out of jail. Which was kind of a tiny system. You get the hell out of here, kid. Whatever you got to say, just say to somebody else, don't bother me. But this has never come up. Liddy said that, you know, they all got counsel instantly and said that, you know, we'll ride this thing out. All right, then they started making demands. Hey, we got to have attorney's fees. We don't have any money ourselves, and this, you're asking us to take this through the election. All right, so arrangements were made through Mitchell, initiating it in discussions that I was present, that these guys had to be taken care of. Their attorney fees had to be done. Kalmbach was brought in. Kalmbach raised some cash. They were, you know... They had a Cuban committee, and they had some of it was given to Hunt's lawyer, who in turn passed it out. You know, when Hunt's wife was flying to Chicago with $10,000, she was actually, I understand, after the fact now, was going to pass that money to one of the Cubans to meet him in Chicago and pass it to somebody there.
Ball player.
He carried tremendous water for us.
He's a lawyer.
No, he is our lawyer at the re-election committee.
I see.
So he's safe. There's no problem there. But it raises the whole question of Hunt now has made a direct threat against Ehrlichman as a result of this. This is his blackmail. He says, I will bring John Ehrlichman down to his knees and put him in jail. I have done enough seamy things for he and Krogh. They'll never survive it.
What's that on Ellsberg?
Ellsberg and apparently some other things. I don't know the full extent of it.
What anything else?
I don't either, and I hate to learn some of these things. So that's that situation. Now, we're at the soft point. How many people know about this? Well, let me go one step further in this whole thing. The Cubans that were used in the Watergate were also the same Cubans that Hunt and Liddy used for this California Ellsberg thing, the break-in out there. So they're aware of that. How high their knowledge is something else. Hunt and Liddy, of course, are totally aware of it and the fact that it was right out of the White House.
I don't know what the
Hogan is for. I don't either. Mr. President, there have been a couple things around here that I've gotten wind of. There was one time a desire to do a second-story job in the Brookings Institute where they had the Pentagon papers. Now, I flew to California because I was told that John had instructed it, and he said I really had this misimpression, but for Christ's sake, turn it off. And I did. I came back and turned it off because, you know, the risk is minimal and the gain is fantastic. It's something else. But with a low risk and no gain, it's not worth it. Well, who knows about this all now? All right, you've got the Cuban lawyers, a man by the name of Rothblatt, who is a no-good, publicity-seeking son of a bitch, to be very frank with. He's had to be turned down and tuned off. He was canned by his own people because they didn't trust him. They were trying to run a different route than he wanted to run. He didn't want him to plead guilty. He wants to represent him before the Senate. So F. Lee Bailey, who was the partner of one of the men representing McCord, got in and cooled Rothblatt down. So Lee Bailey has got knowledge. Hunt's lawyer, a man by the name of Pittman, who's an excellent criminal lawyer from the Democratic era of Bobby Kennedy. You've got knowledge. Not only all the direct knowledge that Hunt and Liddy have, as well as all the hearsay they have. You've got the two lawyers over at the re-election committee who did an investigation to find out the facts. Slowly, they got the whole picture. They're solid, but they know. You've got then an awful lot of all the principals involved know. Some people's wives know. There's no doubt about that. Mrs. Hunt was the savviest woman in the world. She had the whole picture together. Yeah, it's apparently she was the pillar of strength in that family before the death. And
great sadness. The basis of the matter is that there was a discussion between Hunt's father and his wife. And of course, the commutation could be considered on the basis of his wife. That's the only discussion I ever had with anybody.
Right. So that's it. And that's the extent of the knowledge. Now, where are the soft spots on this? Well, first of all, there's the problem of the continued blackmail, which will not only go on now, it'll go on when these people are in prison, and it will compound the obstruction of justice situation. It'll cost money. It's dangerous. Nobody, I think people around here are not pros at this. I mean, this sort of thing mafia people can do. Washing money, getting clean money, and things like that. We just don't know about those things. We're not criminals. We're not used to dealing in that business. It's a tough thing to know how to do. That's right. It's a real problem as to whether we can even do it. Plus, there's a real problem in raising money. Mitchell has been working on raising some money, feeling he's one of the ones the most to lose. But there's no denying the fact that the White House and Ehrlichman, Hallam, and Dean are involved in some of the early money decisions.
How much money?
I would say these people are going to cost $1 million over the next few years.
Mm-hmm. You, on the money, if you need the money, I mean,
that's where...
What happened is, you can get it for $80, and you can get it in cash. I know where it can be gotten.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not easy, but it can be done. But the question is, who the hell would handle it?
That's right.
Any idea on that?
Well, I would think that would be something that Mitchell ought to be charged with.
I would think so, too.
And get some pros to help him.
Let me say, there shouldn't be a lot of people running around getting money.
Well, he's got one person doing it who I'm not sure is... He's got Fred LaRue doing it. Now, Fred started out going out trying to solicit money from all kinds of people, and I learned about that, and I said, my God, it's just awful. Don't do it. People are going to ask what the money's for. He's apparently talked to Tom Pappas. And Pappas has agreed to come up with a sizable amount, I gather, from that.
Well, what do you need?
$1,700,000 to be custodian for. And it came down from New York. It was placed in safe deposit boxes here. Some other people were on the boxes, and ultimately the money was taken out to California. All right. There is knowledge of the fact that he did start with $1.7 million. Several people know this. Now, since 69, he's spent a good deal of this money, and accounting for it is going to be very difficult for Herb. For example, he spent close to $500,000 on private polling. Now, that just opens up a whole new thing. It's not illegal, but it's more of the same sort of thing. No, I don't think so.
Everybody does
polling. That's right. There's nothing criminal about it. It was private polls. It was proper money. That's right. He sent $400,000, as he's described to me, somewhere in the South for another candidate. I assume this was $400 that went to Wallace, right? He has maintained a man who I only know by the name of Tony, who is a fellow who did the Chappaquiddick study and other odd jobs like that. Nothing illegal, but explosive. I don't know of anything that Herb has done that is illegal, other than the fact that he doesn't want to blow the whistle on a lot of people and may find himself in a perky situation.
Because he will be asked about that.
What will happen is when they call him up there, and he of course has no immunity, they'll say, how did you pay Mr. Segretti? Well, I had cash on hand. Well, how much cash did you have on hand?
Right.
Where did you go from there? Where did you get the cash? A whole series of questions. His bank records indicate he had cash on hand, because some of these were set up in trustee accounts.
How would you handle it, John, for example? Would you just have to put the whole thing on?
That doesn't bother me either. There's, as I say, Herb's problems are politically embarrassing, but not criminal.
Well, embarrassing, sure. He just handled matters that were between the campaign before. We were surveys, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's no need to account for that. No law requires him to account for that.
Right. Now,
the source of the money, there's no illegality in having a surplus as a cash.
No, the money, because it's always been argued by Sands, came from
pre-convention.
Pre-primary for the 68 race, which was just set aside. That all can be explained. I think that the other vulnerabilities. We've got a runaway grand jury up in the Southern District.
Yeah.
They're after Mitchell and Stands on some sort of bribe or influence peddling with Vesco. They're also going to try to drag Ehrlichman into that. Apparently Ehrlichman had some meetings with Vesco also. Don Nixon Jr. came in to see John a couple times about the problem.
There's
the fact that
I'm
not job. That's right.
Is it Ehrlichman's totally clear?
Yeah, well, I think the White House, no one has done anything for Vesco.
Not the prosecutor.
No.
Would Ehrlichman and Stedley have to appear there?
For that grand jury? Yes, he could very well.
We could have thrown him there.
Not really. Criminal charge.
Criminal charge. Yeah, what was the charges, Mike? Go ahead.
All right, that's a little different. I think I would be dynamite to defend against that. That's pretty much the overall picture, and probably the most troublesome thing. Well, the Segretti thing, let's get down to that. I think Bob has indicated to me, he told you a lot of it, that he indeed did authorize it. He didn't authorize anything like ultimately evolved. He was aware of it. He was aware that Chapin and Strawn were looking for somebody. Again, this is one that it is potential that Dwight Chapin could have a felony charge against him in this, because he's got a felony. Because he has to disprove a negative. The negative is that he didn't control and direct Segretti.
When the felony being perjury again?
No, the felony, this in this instance, being a potential use of the one of the civil rights statutes for anybody who interferes with a candidate for national office, interferes with their campaign in any way.
Why is it under civil rights statute to pick up any of these clowns that are demonstrating against us?
Well, I've argued they use that for that very purpose.
Really?
Yes, I have. And
those were not interfering with the campaign.
That's exactly right.
But they're ready when I